want to start off just telling you a personal feeling I've been having. I really just don't feel like I'm in Kansas anymore. I've been having this strange feeling that things are changing. I mean, recently, my husband and I bought a new TV, and he, of course, hooked it up to all our other gadgets. And when I wanted to watch a movie on our DVD player, I just didn't know which remote to click, and I had to ask my 11-year-old son to help with that. And then we went to a wedding, the daughter of a friend of ours, and I didn't recognize any of the music. I thought I had been keeping up with the music since I bought Tapestry Revisited, Carole King. And then finally, our newspaper in my local town in North Carolina is allowing high school students to publish a page of the newspaper. And the very first edition of this new section, one of the students had written an article on dressing for success. And in the list of dressing for success was make sure you wear undergarments to your interview. Now, for you, for those baby boomers, that's a no-brainer. So, things are changing, okay? And rightfully so. We need to change. And many of us now are worried about the next generation of leaders. We know that there's concern that 40 to 60% of senior leaders will be leaving their positions, and some people feeling that there will be a leadership gap. At this time, for the first time in history, the number of people leaving the workforce is outnumbering the number of people coming in to the workforce. We have 80 million baby boomers and only 40 million Gen Xers, the group that follows the baby boomers. So just in sheer numbers, there's fewer people in the workforce. We also, many of us feel that our public health students are not going into practice, so we're worried about that. And for some of us, some of the baby boomer or senior leaders who have been around for a while, there actually may be some feelings that there are no, we don't value what the younger generation brings and don't see them as leaders. So I encourage you to explore what you're thinking about, what your feelings are about the different generations. And I'm going to set the stage, as Joyce said, over the next 20 minutes of our time with our panelists. What do senior leaders need to do to help others become successful leaders of the future? And this is sort of a no-brainer, really, but we know that as people come into the public health workforce in a professional position, there's a high need to know your technical and professional skills. But as you take on responsibilities or as you come into a position of either a management or leadership, you need a different skill set. That you could be an excellent nurse, sanitarian, nutritionist, and be a failure at being the leader. And all of these positions are important in public health, as are other supporting positions, but you need different skill sets. And you can see on the right, as you become the executive, the most important skill set that you need are in leadership, that you don't need as much to rely on your technical skills. The senior leaders, when we ask people, what's an emerging leader, and that's what EL stands for on this slide, emerging leader, and we're going to focus on the next generation of leader, although that's not necessarily the only kind of emerging leader we have in public health. But when we ask people, think of someone in your organization that you see, you go, that person's going to make a difference. This person's going somewhere. We ask them to describe what characteristics that person has, and they talk about this person sees the big picture, they're enthusiastic, they have a can-do attitude, they're positive, they identify problems, but they don't complain about them. They actually come up with solutions for those problems. They have excellent skills in relationship building. What they don't have is the years of experience it takes to really define those skills a little better. So it takes years to really become skilled in conflict, managing the political environment, and that's what these young emerging leaders need. We have four generations in the workforce right now. We're going to focus on three of them. You see, right now, the majority of workers are fall into the generation of the baby boomers and the Gen Xers, which are really neck and neck. Now, in some cultures, it's offensive to ask people's ages, but I'd like to do an assessment here. I'm not going to ask you to share your age, but I'm going to ask you how many of you grew up watching Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver? Okay. How many of you grew up watching The Brady Bunch and The Partridge Family? Okay, good. How many of you watched Married with Children? Okay. And how many of you said, the heck with watching other people's families, let's create a second life for myself on the internet? Just so I know how I'm going to offend all of you in my presentation. I'm going to be presenting some of the characteristics of these different generations, just the three, boomers, Xers, and Ys. And these are just general characteristics. You may say, hey, I was born in that time frame of a boomer, but I feel like an Xer. And that's fine. It is a mindset. So what do we mean by generation? We actually mean that there's, in 20 years, people that grow up in the same environment, the same context, form similar values. The first generation, the baby boomers, were born... What just happened here? Yeah, I need an Xer. Oh, wow. Sorry. It didn't work that way. Okay. So sorry. Yeah, I do need an Xer and a Y up here. Help me out. The baby boomers were born between 1945 and 1964, give or take a couple of years. And as you see in this quote, each generation imagines itself to be more intelligent than the one that went before it and wiser than the one that comes after it. The baby boomers really respect or appreciate hierarchy. They respect authority. They work hard, long hours, results-driven. They're loyal to their organization. They want respect. Okay. They do have some perceptions of the generations after them, the Gen Xers. They perceive the Gen Xers, and this is the baby boomers perceiving the Gen Xers, as lazy, unappreciative of working their way up the ladder, wanting more money for less work, and a recognition or a pat on the back for every small success. And the Gen Xers have perceptions of the boomers as well. Can't teach an old dog new tricks. Won't let go, move out of the way, won't get out of the way so the rest of them can lead. They see the baby boomers as preaching fake involvement, preaching involvement that's fake. And now, again, this isn't everyone, but this is some of the perceptions of the different generations, which actually cause some conflict in our workforce. If any of you are on multi-generational teams, you know that you have to sort of appreciate the different things that people bring and work with that. And you may have to deal with conflict because of some of these differences. The Gen Xers actually are considered the generation that's had the hardest childhood of all generations, of those before them and those after them. They were the first generation to, a large percentage of them grew up in divorced or single-parent households. They had very few adults in their life. Okay, they actually bond more with other Gen Xers rather than with adults or the baby boomers. They had material things because both their parents went to work, but they didn't have the adults as much in their lives. They're the first generation that lived with technology from birth. They saw layoffs from companies companies not be loyal to their workers. Mom and dad working really hard and then getting laid off. They were the first generation to be directly marketed to. This is the MTV generation, okay? Where all of us watched Leave It to Beaver and Brady Bunch, the whole family. Now you had specific programs and specific market consumer advertisements targeting this generation. They had a tough childhood, but because of that, they actually came out more independent. They're very independent and self-reliant. For them, security, for many of the baby boomers, they stuck with the company. Security was having that company take care of you for life. For the Gen Xers, security for them is having skills that keep them employable. Okay. As I'm giving you some of these characteristics, I hope you're asking yourself the question, so what? Because the so what is important, especially here. The Gen Xers and the Gen Ys want to learn. This is security for them. And this is in our favor because they're very interested in learning. They're very informal, and they do not respect hierarchy. You need to prove to me as the leader that you're skilled. I'm not just going to accept that because you've been in this position as nursing director for the last 25 years. Okay? They're informal. They seek work-life balance. Their parents, in general, were not around them as they grew up, and now they're seeking more balance for their own kids. Whereas the baby boomers will sit Saturday night writing emails to everyone about the grant that's due on Monday, the Gen Xers are like, this is my home time. It's a big source of conflict in our workforce, actually, right now. Just that. They are more diverse, just like the Gen Y group. They're more diverse, and so they embrace that. They actually prefer, the Gen Xers prefer to work and do their good locally. They think globally, but they actually prefer a more local perspective. There are some handouts in the back of the room, too, with all these slides, if you care to have that. So they, this just adds to that. They want to balance their personal life. They do not like being called into the meeting to represent a different viewpoint when you've already made the decision. They see that as fake. They do value, all generations actually value feedback, coaching, and mentoring, especially this generation. They do not see themselves, because of what they've seen in their environment growing up, they don't trust that the organization's going to be loyal to them. So they don't think anything of moving every couple of years. And they are interested in community work, okay? So they are interested in public health. They just come to it for different reasons. Now, the Gen Y generation is also very technology savvy and, in fact, sees the world as just a click away. Anything they need, they can get access to, and they know how. They have more knowledge about technology, the younger they are, than some of us older, and that's why I have to rely on my 11-year-old son to help with all the technology. Very self-confident. Their dads, they had more involvement from their fathers than the previous generation. They think more globally. This generation is seeing the world. They want to change the world. They want to be heroes in the world. They, too, are outspoken, informal. You may have heard newscasts recently on the national news about many companies giving these younger leaders new titles. They can't give them a raise or anything else, but they're like 20 VPs or 200 VPs in an organization now, vice presidents. They're getting titles of vice president at 20 years old, 22 years old, which seems maybe a little odd to me, but it's important for this generation. They also learn quickly and want meaningful work. Managing multi-generational teams and groups in your organization actually can cause a lot of conflict, and we talked about some of those. Work ethic. I ran into a woman in the grocery store right before I came here, before my flight, and she started talking about how in her a new employee that she hired, how frustrating it was for her that he takes his lunch hour and goes to the break room in their organization and plays cards for that hour. I mean, doesn't he realize we have work to do? You know, that's his lunch hour. So there is this difference in how we see work. And company loyalty and hierarchy, whether you value the hierarchy or not. The older generation does, and the younger does not. Dealing with change, the younger generation is much more able to just go with the flow. And managing technology. These are all things that you have to manage when you manage multi-generational teams and as you develop people that are younger than you, as you help them develop. We know in leadership development that there are many strategies. Now, if you're sitting in the room right now and you see yourself as an emerging or next generation leader, I hope that you are looking over the next 20, 30 years of your life as to what you can do along your lifespan and your career to develop. And there are many things that you can do. If you're looking to leave your legacy and help others develop, I hope you're helping others see down the road what kinds of things they can do. We all know that you can send people off to an academic program or a training program, but you can also help them get feedback by using self-assessment instruments. You can help them develop a plan of development. Not only you can, you should. You should be helping people develop plans, and you should have one yourself. You can get coaching. You can be a coach. You can help people develop mentoring relationships and help people link with their peers. An often missed part of learning is the importance of linking with peers for learning. You can help them journal and learn how to journal in a reflective way, and you can help them on the job. Often in public health, the first thing to be cut is our training and development budget. I'm here to tell you that there are other ways to get training and in fact, or to develop. In fact, when you ask people, where did you learn the most significant leadership lessons in your career, it was not always in a training program. On the job, and it's your job as a leader to help someone develop while they work. We know that people learn leadership throughout their career. A significant part of this is on the job and through practical experiences. And the more varied the experiences you have or they have, the better leadership, the more likely they'll be successful. So you should be developing a portfolio of experiences. We have in our handouts a list of experiences you can yourself either make sure you have or you can help others have. For instance, I've learned myself that I'm very good at startup projects. I can start anything, but I really need to have other experiences. It would be good to have a fix-it job, meaning you go into something that needs to be fixed, you know, it's not going right, an experience with working with problem employees, an experience where you actually help someone get a big leap in the scope of their responsibilities. So as you're helping people develop plans, development plans back at home, or you yourself are developing one, what experiences and skills do you want in your portfolio? We are now going to hear from our panelists. And then, as Joyce said, after that, we'll open it up for discussion and questions. Our first panelist is Tricia. Thank you.
As Joyce mentioned, my name is Tricia Todd, and I'm now the Assistant Director of the Health Career Center at the University of Minnesota. I'm going to talk a little bit, very briefly, about my past experience that is relevant to this topic. You are not getting a PowerPoint because, of course, there's somebody that's been out there promoting the fact that we use too much PowerPoint. You're also not getting a handout, but that has more to do with my age and the fact that I left them sitting at home. So I will give you my email address. I do respond to email still. And if you're interested in this information and what I did print up very nicely that's sitting back in Minnesota, I am happy to send it to you. My email address is my last name, Todd, T-O-D-D, 0002@umn.edu. And my daughter reminds me that I'm a 000. The other thing you can do to get information about what I'm going to talk about is you can actually Google the Emerging Leaders Network and use the word Minnesota with it, and it will come up, I believe, second or third. It keeps bouncing back and forth where it comes up in Google, and there's a lot of information out there about the program. But just a little background, I was actually the president of the Minnesota Public Health Association a number of years ago, and we were having a heck of a time getting somebody to consider taking on leadership roles. And at the time, I was also working at the State Health Department. And one of my colleagues said, how about if we use some of the funding that we were getting through the Robert Wood Johnson Turning Point Program and look at leadership development in Minnesota and what we need to do. So we brought together some folks from the State Health Department, from the local public health agencies, and from the Minnesota Public Health Association, and said, if we were going to create something in this state that could help us identify and nurture future leaders, what would it look like? We ended up creating something called the Emerging Leaders Network, and it is a leadership program. It was designed to identify leaders, future leaders, emerging leaders, and to give them the opportunity to grow in a year-long program from each other. And then we had this concept in our mind about building a network of these future leaders and that they would be able to connect with each other over the years and use this network to enhance public health. We decided we really needed to know what an emerging leader looked like. So we did a little bit of work with our people in leadership positions and said, define an emerging leader. And they gave us a whole host of what they looked for. And the list Donna had was very close to the list we came up with. But we had a few others. We had, highly motivated and enthusiastic. They have a desire to learn and be mentored, are inclined to assume responsibility. They can manage ambiguity, things like that. But then we got down to possess a positive outlook. This turned out to be the number one response we got. People that possess a positive outlook. And they value diversity and actively seek out diverse perspectives. These were the top two. And those were really important to us. So we put this list out there, and we said, we called for applications to this program. We got quite a number of applications to the program. But what we learned is that most of the people that applied to the program did so only after somebody prodded them to. And after going back and talking to folks, we learned that a lot of emerging leaders did not see themselves as leaders, or even emerging leaders. It was more recognizable by other people than by themselves. In fact, I can't tell you how many times we had people that said, I really shouldn't be applying for this because I'm not really a leader. They just didn't see it in themselves. So we learned how important those letters of recommendation were. And we ended up using those letters of recommendation that we required far more than we anticipated having to use them to help identify the potential of these emerging leaders. The program was set up to accomplish three things. Because we were part of the Robert Wood Johnson National Turning Point Project, we were really focusing on skill building around collaborative leadership. And there's a whole set of six principles that we looked at. We also identified, as was mentioned by Donna, we wanted students to help develop their own leadership development plan. We felt that they needed to start to recognize where they were at now and where they wanted to go and how they were going to get there. The other thing that we built into this program was how to build an ethical and resourceful professional network. We knew that talking to people, that the way you get things done is through relationships. And we wanted to make sure that they learned about how you can build those relationships, lasting relationships. What does it take to keep your professional network vibrant? And how do you use it? to grow as a leader. So those were the three components of the program that we had. A couple of the things that I've already mentioned that we learned through this process that are real important is that emerging leaders need to be identified often by others, not by themselves. That the biggest issue they face is a lack of confidence. Bringing them together, having them learn from each other, connecting them to current leaders, which is all part of what we did with the program, resulted in an increase in confidence that allowed them then to be willing to take on added responsibilities, added challenges at work. When we did our evaluation over the last 4 years with this program, that is clearly the greatest outcome we have had, is that so many of these emerging leaders went back and took on additional roles and responsibilities related to leadership because they felt that they gained the confidence. They also gained the network. And within each cohort, they have used each other pretty extensively when they have challenges. We haven't quite achieved the between network growth that we're working on, but we're still working on that piece of it. The other piece that we learned is, and we built this into the program, but it has become more substantial as time has gone on, teaching emerging leaders how to use reflection as a way to grow, and how to use personal reflection and interactive reflection. So choosing and finding a mentor that can help you reflect on what you learned. So it reinforces this need for mentoring. So we've had this great opportunity to build this program, watch it grow, seen some of the outcomes, and it's been a very rewarding thing in Minnesota. We have a few years, I think, to go before we can see some of the outcome as far as filling in some of the positions and the leadership gaps. Then I moved over to the University of Minnesota 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and became the assistant director of the Health Career Center. And I was forced to move from being in public health exclusively and having to now work with medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, vet med, nursing, and public health. And so I had this huge learning curve. The other thing I had to learn was how to work with undergraduates. I had been working with young professionals or professionals in the field, and now I'm working with undergraduates. And the first thing I came up against was, is what I did in the Emerging Leaders Network appropriate for working with undergraduates? And I have learned that you need to tweak what you're doing when you're working with undergraduates. It's not as sufficient to assume that they can work out of the same context because they don't have the experiences. So the one thing I wanted to bring your attention to, and I'm happy to share this with you, is the University of Minnesota has done something I think very progressive. They have identified some student development outcomes. Every course being taught in the undergraduate institution at the University of Minnesota is required to identify how they will address these student development outcomes, and they include things like responsibility and accountability, independence and interdependence, goal orientation, self-awareness, resiliency, appreciation of difference, tolerance of ambiguity. This has forced many faculty, myself included, to go back and look at what I'm teaching and say, how am I helping these students develop towards these outcomes? And that has been a tremendous opportunity for us to help students age appropriately look at leadership. We've also created two other projects at the university that have helped us. One is a leadership minor, and another is a student service learning program that gets students out into the community. And I just want to share one real quick reflection on the commitment to service. I, too, felt that the students had this tremendous commitment to service. And so in one of my courses, I was asking about that as they were identifying the generational differences. And it was quite enlightening to me when the students informed me that, oh, we have to do this. We can't even apply to college if you don't have it on your application. We can't do, we can't get into half the stuff we want to do if we don't do it. And so, of course, I had to follow up and said, well, you'd do it anyway, wouldn't you? They didn't answer. So it was a very enlightening experience for me. And as I mentioned, I will be happy to send any of the information about either one of these perspectives that we have from Minnesota, the Emerging Leaders Network, or some of the activities that we're taking on at the University of Minnesota. Thank you. My email address again, todd0002@umn.edu. Thank you.
Good afternoon. That's the audience participation part. Let's start that over again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Much better, much better. Okay, now I know I'm not alone. Any of you have seen the musical Spamalot, you'll suddenly have a flashback of a very funny song. Which is another story for another day. My name is Teresa Garrett. I work for the Utah Department of Health. I've been there about 11 years. I have served in roles like being the TB nurse consultant. I've been the TB program manager for several years. I served as the state AIDS director. And you probably think, well, they don't have AIDS in Utah, but we do. And also while I was in that role, I did some international work, doing some community building in Botswana. And now I serve as the Division Director for Epidemiology and Laboratory Services, and I'm also the Director of Public Health Nursing, which when you call my voicemail means that you get a really long title. So if you ever call me, just push one. You'll get past all of that. Joyce asked me to spend a little bit of time talking to you about my leadership journey. Joyce is always very complimentary in talking about my skills and abilities in being a mentor and a quick identifier of emerging leaders. And I, putting this talk together has really made me have to think about, well, why is it that I do that? And what is it that's going on? She also asked me to talk about my challenges in my work. And I can sum that up really quickly. I'm responsible for a division of 175 employees, a $27 million budget, things like cryptosporidium outbreaks, E. coli outbreaks, AIDS, STDs. By the way, Utah has the fastest growing gonorrhea rate in any state in the nation in 19 to 24-year-olds. Hepatitis C, laboratory improvement activities around CLIA certification. It's a little bit on the complex side. And all of that is just fine with me. I like all of that part. Because it frankly means there are very few dull moments in my day. However, the part that I suppose is the real challenge for me is that my direct reports include two physicians, a lawyer, a senior epidemiologist, and an accountant. And I'm a nurse. I've never followed a traditional path in my career. When I was in nursing school, the mantra was, you have to do, and actually it still is to this day, you have to do at least 2 years in the hospital to get some good bedside skills before you go out into the community. Not being one to really follow the rules very well, I never did that. And in fact, in my 25 years of being a registered nurse, I have never worked in a hospital. And I went to nursing school knowing that I would go into management. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be the kind of nurse that helped other nurses be good nurses. I've always worked in the community, an Indian health center, long-term care. I did some consulting, went back to home care, and most of the time, well, for the past 11 years, in public health. My nursing practice has always followed a very holistic model. That's the part that interests me. I'm much more about over-the-fence backyard nursing with my neighbors and the troubles with their elderly parents. Concerns about my nieces who might not be developing language skills and where could I refer them than I am about Foley catheters and dressing changes and ventilators. That's never been, frankly, very sexy to me. And I suppose that because I've always been mentored and coached and highlighted in some way by the leaders that I've worked with, I find doing the same thing quite natural. When my father died very suddenly about 19 years ago, I was certainly overwhelmed, but mostly, when I reflect back on it, what I was overwhelmed about was all of the people who said to me what a great guy he was. And that was literally the exact phrase that they used over and over and over again. And in fact, we put it in his obituary because so many people had said that to us. They said things like, he was the best boss I ever had. He gave me a chance. He helped me when I needed a hand. He sent me to rehab. One person even said he sent me to rehab twice. He helped me go back to school. He helped me get a promotion. Things like that. I realized in that period of time that my father was not going to be around to help me. But I'm lucky because he sent me some messages that still resonate in my mind today. So what have I done to help that legacy live on? Even before I knew about Kunz's and Posner's leadership tenets, I knew that there were several things I needed to do so that I could help other people be successful. First, I had to model the way, right? Many of you can memorize these, right? How many of you can say all five of them? Yeah. Without having them written down like I do. Encourage others to act. Encourage the heart by celebrating success, challenging the process, and inspiring a shared vision. So I have probably four or five things that, as I think about my leadership journey and my path, that I have left to chance, but now try to be much more intentional about them. First, I have always tried to learn. I have remained committed to my own management and leadership development. And in the early 90s, when I returned to do my graduate work, I really challenged the folks at our College of Nursing, because I'm a bit of a purist in terms of nursing, but because I wanted to do nursing administration, but I didn't want to go into a hospital, and that's where they thought I needed to go. Whether it's a new job that presents a new challenge, a workshop, a leadership course, a fellowship, which I am doing currently, I did it, and I especially did it if a leader or someone in a leadership position told me to do it. I had a nursing professor who would often come up to me and say, "Teresa, boy, have I got a deal for you." And I knew instantly that it was something that was going to be a stretch for me and that I had to take a very deep breath and then jump in. So I've remained committed to learning. The second thing I've done is to create a learning environment, which isn't easy to do, frankly, in public health because, as we've already mentioned, your training budget is the first thing that goes. But I sort of figure if I have to learn, so does everybody else. And in that spirit, I've really tried to push the people that I work with. When Joyce came to me a few years ago and said, "Hey, there's this thing called a Regional Leadership Institute," we went. She grabbed me by the arm and said, "Let's go." So I went, and several of our leadership staff have gone, and they're still going. We're working now on the sort of second tier level of leaders to attend a leadership institute. And of the 21 managers and section chiefs in our division, 14 of them have attended some sort of a leadership institute in the past 5 years. I am currently on my third experience through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in the Executive Nurse Leadership Fellowship Program. I'm not necessarily sure that because I'm now on my third experience, that's necessarily a good thing. Because I thought about that last night. I thought, "Oh, three, is that impressive or not? They just keep sending me to more things. Keep going. You know, I haven't quite got it yet." The other piece about developing a learning environment is that in our institution, it takes us on average 7 weeks to hire an individual. Particularly epidemiologists and registered nurses are a huge challenge for us. I'm sure they're not a challenge for any of you in the audience. So we hire fresh out of school, graduate students, and others. And we say to particularly those we hire with a bachelor's degree who are very motivated and interested in the work that they have to have an MPH within 3 years of hire. And we have figured out a way to pay for it. Which is probably the most sentinel event if I can look back in our division of how we're improving the process. The third thing is to grow from within when you can. There's a recent Harvard Business Review article that talks about mentorship and developing and succession planning and how you do that. And that the most successful individuals are really the people you hire from within. But you have to balance that with hiring from within and bringing in new blood, because sometimes you need it. I've done things like hiring a French major to run the tuberculosis program and a lawyer to be in charge of the HIV treatment and care program. And I did it because both of these individuals were what I call bright, shiny stars. People who were, as have been described to you earlier, and frankly, if you pay attention, these folks are very easy to spot. They sparkle all on their own, and they do it even brighter when you shed just a little bit more light their way. Finally, I've learned to never work alone. This has been actually quite a challenge for me. I mentor teenage girls through an organization that I'm involved with back home. And I often say to them, if you're doing something all by yourself, there's something very wrong with what you're doing. This world is not about being by yourself. Being in a global world is about being much bigger than yourself. And now that I find myself in an emerging... Now, the last point I wanted to make was trying to recognize your own emerging role. As I have moved through different leadership positions, my role as a mentor has changed quite a bit. I'm now a senior leader at the State Health Department, and my role in leadership development and spotting emerging leaders is a little bit different. With our leadership team, which is they are top-notch, there's no doubt about it, I find that my job is to help them learn to stop the sparklers. In closing, I wanted to just share with you, I've given you a one-page handout. In trying to develop a learning environment and a learning institution, we've developed something that we call a balanced scorecard. Some of you might be familiar with this tool. And I've tried to identify, and we call it scientific competence and excellence in our division. And I've tried to highlight some of the things we're trying to measure around, are we really a learning institution? And the final piece I wanted to say is to all of you who are, I would say, probably over 35 in the room. So the rest of you can just kind of, you know, do one of these. What I have learned is that it's no longer about paying dues. It's not about working your way up through the chain. And it's not about seniority. It's about flexibility. It's about technology. And to paraphrase Jim Collins from his book, Good to Great, it's about creatively positioning the right people on the right bus, on the right street, in the right seats, and then getting out of the way. Thank you.
Hello, I am a self-proclaimed Gen Xer. I think they were hoping for a Gen Yer, but they got a Gen Xer. My name is Amy Carroll Scott, and I am a doctoral candidate at the UCLA School of Public Health. And when I'm not working on finishing up my dissertation, I run a statewide capacity building program where I teach community leaders how to do basic needs assessments. They're largely from the baby boomer generation. I didn't realize how many generational gaps I was dealing with until today. And I manage a staff of Generation Xers and Generation Yers, that's how you say it, to be technical assistance providers and trainers in that effort. So I speak from that experience today. And I'm also speaking from the experience that you heard about earlier. I was the student assembly liaison to the Community Health Planning and Policy Development section here at APHA, and when I got into the section and saw all of the enthusiasm of all of the leaders in the section about new leaders in the section that are students and emerging new professionals, And I realized there was no place for that. There was no institutionalized role for students to participate in the ongoing business and governance of the section. And that's when I created the student committee. It's the first standing student committee in the section, the first one in APHA. And I speak also from my experience in that, in trying to develop new leaders, new lasting leaders within this, the section, within APHA, and also so that they could exist beyond when I graduate, hopefully, this spring, so that it could be an institutionalized role for students within the section. So I'll be talking a little bit. Joyce asked me to talk about some tips for engaging emerging leaders. What was said earlier, I didn't realize I was an emerging leader, but I guess I am an emerging leader. And so I wanted to talk about some 5 tips that I came up with, and I have a handout in the back, and give just a few examples of how they've worked or not worked for me. The first is to take advantage of the enthusiasm and fresh perspectives that students and new professionals bring to a volunteer or a professional organization. But that students will be easily discouraged. They will quickly lose interest, especially if it's a volunteer position. They may completely fall off the radar if they're given just grunt work with no apparent opportunity to build new knowledge and skills. What I've done in this sense is to ensure that the positions that I create include opportunities to learn both about the organization, which is particularly true with APHA, but also to grow from their current skill set to a new skill set, one that they have the ability to contribute to determining, the skills that they are interested in developing for themselves. And in that process, to provide mentorship, whether it's from me or to identify the appropriate mentors to allow them to grow to that new skill set. That involves also developing clear roles and responsibilities, again, allowing them to contribute to the development of, or the identification of the roles and the responsibilities they'd like to take on, while allowing and encouraging students to grow the position in new ways according to their interests and abilities. I had a student working for me who was a work study in Generation Wire, an undergraduate at UCLA, who took on an administrative role as a work study position to gain some extra hours and some money, some breaks from tuition. And what I found was that although she quickly brought enthusiasm to the role and to the work that we were doing, her administrative role didn't really allow her to participate in what was providing this capacity building program statewide. And so she quickly started to wane in her enthusiasm, and what we did was allowed her to take on the role of web manager, which was something that she decided was a skill that she wanted to do. She was excellent at it, taking advantage of those technical skills of Generation Wires. You know, she can out-text message me, and so she put those to good use, and she's a fantastic web manager, as well as takes a lot more seriously her responsibilities as in her administrative role. The second point I wanted to make was to provide clear professional benefits. This has been mentioned previously, that students are motivated by career development opportunities. These include mentorship, networking with both peers and mentors, and also potential employers and graduate program faculty, new skills or experience that will help develop their CV and their career development. And awards are elected or selected positions that they can add to their CV. Again, more CV building opportunities. And I encourage you to make sure to build those benefits into any student or emerging leader, new professional position, and to highlight these actually in the recruitment positions, in your recruitment efforts for those positions. And what happened with me in the new student committee, I wanted to bring in new leadership, new members, lots of enthusiasm. And what I found was that everyone had enthusiasm up front, and then when finals came or they had to move it out of the dorm or, you know, transition to their new graduate degree program or whatever the case might be, they completely fell off the radar. And what I decided to do was to actually create official committee positions so that they weren't just members of the student committee helping us achieve our goals, but that they were actually these formalized positions where students were actually created liaison positions between our student committee and all the other committees within our section. So that there's a student representative to our program chair now. There's a student representative to our membership committee and to our communications committee and our policy and resolutions committee. And what I found was that when I advertised those positions, I got a ton of applications, and those students have been engaged the entire time. It was something they were able to put on a CV. It was something they were proud of that they had earned, and so they took a lot more ownership and engagement in that position. My third point is, excuse me one second, I also live in Southern California, so I'm losing my voice. First wildfires and then colder weather. So the third point I want to make was to provide a thorough orientation. I think when we've been in volunteer organizations or professional organizations for too long, we forget what others don't know, who are new to the organization or new to the position. And this is especially true of students and new professionals because there will be rapid turnover. And you will need to provide an ongoing orientation as new students or new young professionals take on these roles. So I advise developing orientation materials to use each time students or new professionals take on a new role. It'll certainly cut the time out for doing it, but it can also provide an opportunity for you to allow students to contribute to those orientation materials. As they either transition into the role or transition out of the role, they could provide their expertise, their perspective on what the role and the organization have to offer new students or new emerging leaders who take on the position after them. And this can allow for greater student contribution and ownership of that process if given to them, greater institutional memory as you're not starting from scratch each time a new student comes into the role, and longer-term sustainability of the role of students in these positions. We did this in our student committee. One of the first things was identified as being a problem was that students do not understand what the organization of APHA is, how it works, how they could take advantage of it. And as a new governing counselor, I realized part of that is because it's constantly changing. So what we did was we provided an orientation brochure for new students to our section explaining APHA, what is it, what does it do, how to take advantage of it, and links to all the important pieces on the APHA website, and in a way that was written for students, and in particularly students involved in community health and policy development as the students in our sections tend to be. My fourth point is to anticipate competing commitments, set ground rules, create work plans. Students in particular, but new professionals as well, take on many different roles, have a lot of competing priorities, including, for example, exams, classes, which usually take top priority when they come around. And so, in particular, younger students may not have the ability to determine what they can commit to within their competing priorities, and so may fall, again, as I mentioned before, fall off the radar when exam periods come around. It's important then to set ground rules that talk about encouraging students to take on the tasks that they feel they could feasibly achieve given what other competing priorities and commitments that they have. And a way to do this is to develop an evolving work plan where students contribute to what they're interested in being involved with as well as see what's coming up down the road so that they can better manage their time and their commitments. We did this in the Community Health Planning and Policy Development Student Committee, and it's worked incredibly well. And I found that not only did students fall off the radar less when they felt they were included in developing the work plan and deciding for themselves what they were going to volunteer to take on, but also the timeline allowed them to see what was coming up, and they were much better able to manage their priorities. I also do this at work as well, although we have to have work plans or else it just would never work. And then my last point is to anticipate turnover and to ensure sustainability. As I mentioned before, there will be very great turnover in student positions, especially if they are, by definition, one-year-long, summer-long internships, these kind of transitional stepping stones in career development, especially volunteer positions and part-time jobs, work studies, and the like. It's important the students will not be able to look to sustainability and longer-term sustainability. They don't have that perspective of the organization and how these stepping stone transitional internship positions are not only contributing to the ongoing work of the organization, but also to their leadership development. So you will need to develop a sustainability plan, including how students will be replaced, how they'll be trained and oriented, and how new students will be included in this ongoing work plan for the organization. So to build in time for students to document the process that they've made to date and position descriptions of what did their position grow into during their tenure in order to provide that to their replacement. This way, each time a new student replacement comes in, you're not starting from scratch. There's actually been this institutionalized progression of not only the student role, but also the work that they were contributing to. And I've done that in my own statewide capacity building program, where I have actually asked my trainers to train their trainer replacements, which is a little confusing because it's actually a train-the-trainer program. So we train the trainers to train the trainers, but it's worked. So that's it. Thank you so much. I look forward to answering your questions.